Welcome to this new episode of Spotlight on Africa, a podcast by RFI English. I'm Melissa Shamam, and twice a month in this podcast, I look at one major issue on the continent, one country or one idea at a time. This week, we focus on Africa's diplomacy for 2025. With South Africa leading the G20 for a year, West Africa chasing French soldier out, and Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger insisting on leaving the West African economic bloc, we can ask ourselves, how could this year unfold for Africa's leading nation and their partners? Will the continent take a more central place in the global diplomatic conversation, as many expect? And can this stop the worst conflict and control insecurity? This is what we're going to discuss in this episode. First, South Africa takes the rotating presidency of the G20 for the first time in 25 years of existence of this group. The G20 represents the 19 most powerful economies in the world, plus the European Union and recently added the African Union. Unlike the G7, this platform is praised for representing powers including some of the largest nations in the global south, like Brazil and South Africa. Let's try to evaluate the implications of South Africa's presidency for the whole of Africa. This presidency presents a unique opportunity to enhance the continent's development priorities on the global stage. That's at least what President Cyril Ramaphosa said from November last year. My first guest is Cameron Hudson, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in the US. He reflects on the position of South Africa on the global stage and in Africa and about its relations with the United States especially.
I think that South Africa has lost a lot of its influence. It's lost a lot of its moral, authority, given the problems of the ANC, given the weakening of South African institutions, given the corruption scandals of the ANC, obviously its political losses domestically. The ANC is no longer the kind of conscience of the African continent that it was. It's a liberation party that is suffering a similar fate to many other liberation parties across the continent right now. And so it is no longer the South Africa of Nelson Mandela. But I don't think that it carries the same moral weight that it used to. And I think that it understands that. I think it's tried to regain some of that, for example, with its position on Gaza and Israel. It's trying to, that in my mind is a reflection back to the kind of ANC of old, that it's taken that position. But again, I don't know that the position that it has taken has been especially productive. And so I do think that South Africa is a diminished, it's diminished on the continent. It's certainly also because of its own economy. It's suffering economically. It can't keep the lights on. So now all of a sudden, South Africa, it doesn't look like the exceptional case of Africa that it used to. It now looks like Nigeria or, a host of other African countries that struggle with, debt, that struggle with economics, that struggle with basic infrastructure. And so the more South Africa looks like many other countries in Africa, the less claim it has to a leadership role on the continent. Now, obviously, it is doing what it can to change all of that, but it hasn't, fully succeeded yet.
So I just wanted you to elaborate a little bit on your reflections about how this could change the relations between Pretoria and Washington. Do you see this as an obligation for South Africa to switch a little bit its narrative?
Well, I think that if South Africa doesn't kind of moderate some of its positions, it's going to find itself, I think, really at odds with the incoming Trump administration. Already, the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress have reacted very strongly over the past, 2 or 3 years to South Africa's statements and policies. Towards Russia, towards China, and particularly towards Israel, which it has defined as a threat to U.S. national security interests. So South Africa really needs to find a way to work with Washington. Similarly, Washington, I think, is going to have to understand better why South Africa has taken these positions in the past and why they're taking them again now, and figure out who South Africa really is. Anybody who has studied South Africa knows that they've been largely consistent in these positions over many decades. And I think that it stems from, their own history or their view of their own history. At the same time, Washington and Americans are notoriously bad about forgetting history, right? And so Washington, I think, is largely ignorant of its long history of supporting white apartheid rule in South Africa. That does not figure into the collective conscience of American officials or policymakers. The only thing that Americans remember about our role in South Africa is that we were a leading voice to end apartheid. And that is true, but that was the last decade of apartheid, and it wasn't the first, 90 years of apartheid. And so I think that South Africans obviously take a much longer, more nuanced, more complete view of their own history. And when they do, that puts the United States largely on the wrong side of that history. And from their perspective, puts countries like Russia, and to a lesser extent, China on the right side of their history. And so that's not something that Washington has come to terms with. Certainly not something I expect the Trump administration to necessarily come to terms with. So I think we're going to struggle to overcome our own histories in the terms of this relationship. I think the way forward, as you suggest early, was how we will use the opportunity around something like the G20 to hopefully build bridges and not to have the relationship further distanced.
Then about the G20, what some observers have been writing is that actually the key event in South Africa might not have been already set because they might be expecting Donald Trump to announce if he's coming or not. Do you think it's likely, and do you think it's important?
Honestly, I would be very surprised if he went to the G20 in South Africa. But at the same time, I would probably be surprised if the G20 was being held anywhere that he would go. I don't know that it's necessarily a reflection on South Africa. I think it's a reflection more on the fact that I don't think he sees a lot of value in multilateral diplomacy and coordination, especially at that level, right? The G20, I think there's a lot of people who question what the value and the utility of the G20 is. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Washington decided that it didn't want to participate in the G20 going forward. I think things like the G7 might be more of a venue for the United States to play in, but I think it's a bigger question about just wider multilateral diplomacy, which I don't think the Trump administration is particularly committed to. That's number one. Number two, I think it would be valuable as somebody who studies African relations for President Trump to go to a G20, especially if it is in South Africa. I think the message that I would send to the Trump administration is that South Africa is also an important country in Africa. It is an important country in the global South. It's very influential. And so our relationship with South Africa will set the tone for a wider set of relations across Africa and the global South. And so, if we care about those much broader relationships, which I think we should, then we can't afford to alienate South Africa. We have to find a way to work with them. And so, I think it would send a very important message for President Trump to go. That being said, my expectation is that he won't go unless he can extract some kind of concessions from South Africa. We have, again, a number of very difficult issues related to China and Russia and Israel with South Africa, and I don't think that he will go and pay them the honor of a visit if he doesn't first see some kind of moderation in the positions that they have taken publicly.
We also wanted to know if South Africa leading the G20 this year could be a good opportunity for other partners, and especially China. My colleague, Jan van der Meijde, asked Michael Dielen, a historian working on China at King's College London.
Hello, The fact that the G20 will be in South Africa, I mean, is that good news for China?
I haven't seen any statement from the Chinese about this. But, I mean, they've got their own organization for dealing with China, dealing with Africa, the Forum on China-African Cooperation, which has been in existence for, I think, 19, 20 years now. And so they're using that for their own influence. I think the other interesting thing is that I've stressed the political, but these aren't just political in the sense of strategic power. They're also trying to get African politicians, leaders on their side for negotiations at the United Nations, and I presume something like the G20, where the Chinese have obviously, for reasons that we both understand, been criticized and for human rights issues and other things. And if they've got economic relations with African countries, which are also having to deal with these problems, they may find they can get political support from those, which would help them out to the G20, and in particular, I think, in the United Nations.
Michael Dillon also reflects on the potential competition in Africa between China, Europe, the US and Russia.
In investing in Africa, clearly there are economic aspects to it. Local government is looking for Chinese local governments are looking for places to earn money. Chinese corporations want to develop infrastructure projects. How much return they'll get on that, I'm not enough of an economist to say. But what it seems to me is that there's a strategic purpose behind all of this, that China is aware of Western countries pulling out of certain parts of France militarily, not really taking as much interest diplomatically. And China has been really taking interest in Africa 30, 40 years. It's certainly, before the Cultural Revolution and during the Cultural Revolution, there was great emphasis on China-Africa relations, not always to the benefit of the Africans, but there's a long-standing political interest in Africa.
Do you think there is anything for the Europeans to learn from the Chinese strategy when it comes to Africa?
Yeah, I think there is, and I think it's that it's consistency, building up a long-term relationship, which is what the Chinese have always insisted on. They don't like people who come in and make promises and then go out again. They want people who are prepared to take the rough with the smooth and to accept that a long-term relationship is the only way of developing mutual interest. I mean, a lot of it is also to do, from the Chinese point of view, to do with, as we've already said, competing with the United States, competing with Europe, and we haven't mentioned this, but competing with Russian influence, which is really reduced recently since the various debacle of Russian mercenaries in Africa. But I think because there is a political impetus behind it, some of the economic projects will be made to work.
In the light of the increasing tensions between China and Western countries, how important is Africa as a strategic partner for China? What role does it play in China's broader geopolitical global ambitions?
Quite an important role, I think. I mean, first of all, if you look at the maritime trade, it's been fairly obvious for some time that China has been interested in the eastern seaboard of Africa, with investment in the port at Dar es Salaam on the Indian Ocean. Less obvious, and I think I wasn't aware of it until quite recently, on the Atlantic seaboard in Namibia. China is also developing facilities. These are initially, as far as I can see, commercial ones for the for maritime trade. I mean, China wants to have a certain amount of stability and security for its sea routes to the west to sell its goods. But I think there also almost certainly there's the potential for military bases as well.
You're listening to Spotlight on Africa with Melissa Shaman on Radio France International.
In terms of geopolitics in other parts of Africa, in 2025, tensions between France and French-speaking African countries are likely to escalate or deepen. After Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso, more former French colonies reassess their historical ties with the former colonial power. I spoke to three French experts and all agreed. Antoine Glazer said that Chad and Senegal consider that they have been regaining sovereignty in their relationship to France, and they reacted strongly recently to Emmanuel Macron's remark on the presence of French soldiers. These ones are going to leave, they're going to leave Ivory Coast as well, and there, Glazer said, a treaty might have been discussed, but in the case of Chad and Senegal, the decisions were coming from Africa and they are now furious at Macron. So for the expert, Macron's strategy is actually, and I quote, completely counterproductive, because it is obvious that these countries have now the whole world in their waiting room. Global powers dynamics evolve, and French-speaking African countries are now increasingly looking at partners in China, we've seen that, in Russia, but also in the United Arab Emirates. For Thierry Vircoulon, Africa researcher at the French Institute for International Relations, what Macron said was definitely off script.
There was some sort of a security pact negotiated just after independence between a lot of French-speaking African countries and France. And over time, that security pact became more problematic, probably also less relevant for the African countries. And it was, of course, during the past 65 years, that security pact was renegotiated, changed, and therefore, for a lot of African countries, it didn't seem relevant anymore.
But then again, on Macron's speech, do you think there's a strategy behind Macron's words, or do you think it's just a missed opportunity to kick better conversation, really?
Definitely, when he said that, he was off script. And he's very much used of speaking his mind publicly, which, of course, is not a good idea. And therefore, he made many mistakes like that in the past. And it's one more mistake. The problem is that with the social media now, this kind of little sentences become the main argument. And that's why he should be much more careful when he's speaking.
Regarding the situation in the Sahel itself, for Cameron Hudson that we heard earlier, the current conflict with ECOWAS does not bode well for the Sahelian state, however, especially on the security level.
In the three Sahelian states, as they become more isolated within the region, and as they become more and more reliant on Russia, I think that we've already seen the trends on the ground are that the terrorism problem is getting worse, not better. And the situation for civilians in those countries is getting worse, not better. Both the humanitarian, the security, and the economics are getting worse, not better. And I don't think that any of those trends are going to be reversed while military juntas are in power, while Russia has a privileged position both economically and politically and from a security perspective in these countries. So the long-term viability, frankly, of these countries relies on a much wider range of outside support to help them out of this crisis. That includes the regional states who are the most affected by what's happening, the neighboring states, but it also includes the international community. And I think, you know, from the perspective of Washington, I think many security officials here would say that, or what I hear them say is, let them try to sort this out with the Russians, and they will eventually come back to the international community and to the West. And you frankly hear President Macron saying something similar, right? Which is, they'll be back. The Russians can't solve their problems. They're going to have to rely on us, so they're going to have to depend on other outside forces to help them. And it will be only when the citizens of those countries reject those military juntas, which, again, I think people believe that they will eventually do as the situation continues to get worse, That could take a very long time, and that could imply, you know, very serious consequences for the region. And I think that as much as there doesn't seem to be any appetite right now to try to rush in to help, because people are, I think, quite happy to see Russia fail at this exercise, I think that over the long term, it would be foolish to allow these countries to become totally collapsed and failed states, like we have seen in places like Libya or Somalia, where the terrorists really take over. I think if we wait for Russia to fail and for these countries to fail, it will be in many ways far too late to try to salvage something in these places.
Thanks again to our guests this week, Cameron Hudson, Michael Dillon and Thierry Vircoulon, for their analysis. We've had a look at some strategic regions in Africa, their diplomacy and the views from their partners, and we'll soon hear more from African analysts in Africa. We'll also talk further about the G20. This was the latest episode of Spotlight on Africa, a podcast produced by RFI English. It was mixed by our sound engineer, Erwan Rome. Thanks, Erwan. And thanks to you for listening. We'll be back soon to comment on more African affairs. In the meantime, you can always read us on our website, rfi.fr/en.